From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
Our state's elected officials are well known. But what about those behind-the-scenes movers and shakers in California politics? We'll ask someone who annually compiles a list of the most influential unelected policymakers at the state capitol, John Howard, editor of Capitol Weekly.
We'll also hear from Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee, Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star and the Modesto Bee, and Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta, about Valley movers and shakers.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, as well as support from Era Energy LLC, Bonner Family Foundation, Community Medical Centers, Harris Ranch Inn and Restaurant, Nossaman LLC, Sagasser Watkins and Whelan, and Valley Children's Hospital. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome, I'm Mark Kepler with the Matty Institute. In any state capital, there are those key power brokers who work behind the scenes to get things done. They're well known to those in the know. Our guest is John Howard, editor of Capitol Weekly, a well-read publication that annually publishes a list of California's top 100 power players. Welcome back to the Matty Report.
Thank you, Mark. I'm happy to be here. And God bless you for saying well-read when you talk about Capitol Weekly.
Okay. It's true. It's a very well-read magazine. Anyway, so, you know, you've noted that sparks are sometimes fly when these things come out, the diverse reactions on folks. What did you hear this year?
You know, it's funny. We didn't hear a lot of that this year. There were some people who were not on the list that were on last year. Partly that's a matter of strategy. We want to shake things up a bit and get some new blood onto the list and not have sort of a sense of entitlement from the year to year. A couple people that were off did call me, and in very spirited, robust language, wondered what was going on. We sorted all that out. I think the biggest issue going into this list that I had was who was going to be number one. Nancy McFadden, who had been number one for quite some time, passed away.
Right. He was the chief of staff for the governor.
Yes. So what were we going to do with number one? And so my thought was Diana Dooley, who was Governor Brown's first public appointee when he was elected in 2010 and had been with him in various capacities since 1975. She was Health and Human Services Secretary. She was just named to be the cabinet executive secretary. So I thought that would make an obvious number one. And I ran that by people and absolutely nobody agreed with me. They said Ann Gus Brown should be number one again because she, after Nancy died, sort of stepped back into the
We're gonna talk about that in a second. Let me ask you this. Your list is a little bit subjective.
I mean,
you know, it's kind of talking truly to folks and not totally empirical. Are there any new criteria that you use this year?
I think the criteria are very similar to what we've always used. What we try to do is ask people who they think in the capital community are sort of outsized to their title and their jobs. They may have a fancy title and they may have a fancy job, but what do they do with that? And that is very subjective, as you say. And so in this list, we had several people who were not on last year's list, but who quite clearly belonged after we talked to as many people as we could. So the criteria is subjective, but we're basically looking at people who are effective in their jobs, non-electeds, obviously, who are effective.
And you've got a lot of contacts in the Capitol, and so you can find out who really are the power players.
And some of them still talk to me, so that's
right.
Good. It's good for the list.
So some people get dropped off the list. Yeah. New ones are added, you said. I'm imagining that some folks that get dropped off the list are a little upset. Yeah. Their name didn't appear on this year's list. How do you mollify those folks? And can you tell us what their response was? Did they accept your explanation?
Some did not get in touch with me at all. A few did. But it's funny, the people who were off the list this time had been on before and off before and back again. So there is sort of a revolving merry-go-round, sort of a revolving door quality to this.
They're expecting to be on next year.
I think so, yeah. Not that I've told them, but yeah.
Their expectations are. Well, you know, we're going to talk about the top 10 in a moment.
Sure.
But I wanted to ask you about, you said about 20% of the folks in this year's list are newcomers to the top 100. Can you tell us about some of them that are new to this year's list in the top 100? Not in the top 10, but, you know, 11 through 100. Why were they added to the list?
some of them were added, again, and people we talked to said, you know, you really got to talk to so-and-so. That person, you may not know it before, but it's in the horseshoe very close to the governor. And now
and the horseshoe,
way,
you can explain to our audience,
is sort of the inner sanctum of the executive office suite for the governor. It's over here in the Capitol.
And it looks like a horseshoe. I mean, the offices are shaped in a horseshoe.
That's true.
A rampant, yeah. Okay.
And so there are people there who weren't on the list before that we didn't know about. And so this year there was sort of an educational quality to this year's list, believe me. One of the best thing that we learned this year, I think, title-wise, is that the governor likes his top staff with the titles secretary in them. And the press secretary for the governor hadn't been on the list before because I thought he answered to a communications director. Mm-hmm. No, the press secretary is the communications director and is up with the governor in the morning and with him all day, and at night leaves him, and that person belonged on the list and is on the list this year and has not been on before.
So. Oh, there you go. So you have a happy press secretary.
We have a happy press
secretary. Which is good since you're in that business, media business.
Still doesn't call me back, though, but it's okay.
I'm sure he or she is happy. Up next, we're actually going to talk about who are the 10 most influential behind-the-scenes players in California government. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. So who are the 10 most powerful players in Sacramento politics? We're talking with John Howard, editor of Capital Weekly, who publishes the annual list of the top behind-the-scenes players in California. We have the magazine with us. You can show that to our audience. This is what we're talking about, and we're talking about the top 10 on this list.
And this is not a shameless plug.
Not a shameless plug.
Okay, good.
This is what you want to order if you're really interested in all top 100. We're going to focus on the top 10. So at number 10 is Elaine Howell, who's the state auditor, frequent guest actually on our program, so our audience knows her well. So why is she on the list?
She's always on the list at some point or another. I mean, she's at some level or another, she's on the list by virtue of her position. She's very aggressive. She's managed to please the Joint Legislative Audit Committee in somewhat for many, many years, which is not the easiest thing to do. She's done some really tough audits. This past year or two, she really got into it with UC. There were issues there with UC's finances. There were questions about whether UC was forthright with her. She's dogged. You don't mess with Elaine Howell. So she was pretty easy call for 10.
And she was taking on the regents of the UC and,
yes.
and the top officer over there. And it's interesting. She has quite, she seems very pleasant. We
she
talked
is,
to her on,
yeah.
on the show. So
if she's not after us, she's pleasant.
We're not being audited. So that's good. So at number 9, audience also knows this person very well. Actually, one of two people in the top 10 that are from the San Joaquin Valley, and that's Mac Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
The California's nonpartisan legislative analyst.
Yeah.
He's retiring at the end of this year.
Yes.
Your office, I think, described him very nicely. You said it's the go-to place for anyone looking to understand the nitty-gritty of the California budget, fiscal impact on budget initiatives, and an array of budget-related topics. I don't think anybody would disagree with that.
I agree.
So,
yeah.
Mac Taylor, why is
he
on the list?
First and foremost, Mac Taylor is really easy to understand when he talks about fiscal issues. That's great.
Also, it's interesting, we have him on the show, we talk about the budget, and most people's eyes would glaze over.
Yeah.
Mac makes it so interesting.
He makes it easy,
and
we like that too. So, also, he's very, he makes people at the legislative analysts available. The individual analysts who handle particular policy areas, you know, healthcare, transportation, social services, but if you call them and ask them, like we do conferences, for example, if they'd like to participate publicly or I'm doing a story, can you talk for the record? They do. They often do. And that wasn't always true before with the ledge analyst. The person who was the actual ledge analyst was the main voice.
Right.
But Mac has sort of spread it around.
He's
it's pretty
good.
Cool.
He had a meeting, he told me, with his group, and he said, how many people have been on the Maddie Report? He said like 2/3 of the room raised their hands.
I love
so we're
it, yeah.
always going back to them because they're the experts in various areas.
Absolutely.
So yeah, a good person. At number 8, up from number 10 last year, is Alan Zarenberg, the president and CEO of the California Chamber of Commerce, another person we have on the program. Consistent top 10 power player.
Yeah. You know, I ask people every year, should he be on the list again? We're getting tired of Alan Zarenberg. Should he be on the list? And they all say, yes, he definitely should be on the list.
They've got Chamber, that jobs killer bills every year they come out with.
Jobs killers, jobs pack. They've got...
But
they've
they're
got election
extremely, people say, you know, California is a very democratic state, but the chamber has been incredibly successful with these job killer bills. They knock them out.
That's really why he's on the list. That they're very good. They're very savvy election strategists. They target mod Democrats. They're not just business wise, they have classic business, sort of the Republican bent on business, but they're tight with money, except for campaigns. They spend money in campaigns. They spend their political money They're all over the place. So they're just, they're a major player in SAG. And they have been for, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 years.
Yeah, let's talk about number seven on the list. Again, moving up from number eight last year, Eric Bauman, mm-hmm. who's the chair of the California Democratic Party, is taking over for John Burton. And there's lots of stories about John Burton. But let's talk about Eric Bauman. Why is he on the list? Why do you think he's so important?
Well, we think he's important because part of this is because he was a labor leader in L.A. And he basically called the shots in L.A. And that in itself is a big deal. Then going to the state Democratic Party as chair, it's a funny thing, we didn't have Burton on the list. When he was Democratic Party, I just realized this, you were talking, but we have Bauman on the list. And he sort of combines both. I think he's a major labor figure in California. And now he really does a strategy for the Democratic Party. He's hands-on. He really gets engaged. He knows how to move money around. He's very aggressive.
And the thing about registered voters, I mean, the Democrats have, what, almost 44 percent of the registered voters in California Democratic, and the Republicans are down at, what, 25%, and no party preference, independent voters, they're also 20%.
They're down lower, and yet California has a heavy Republican presence at the local level.
Right.
I believe I'm right when I say that California's local officials, there are more Republicans than there are Democrats.
I think
we have
correct.
This perception of a blue state, but the reality is there's a lot going on in California. Republicans are part of that.
Okay, at number six, a study from last year is also number six, is Robbie Hunter, the president of the State Building and Construction Trades Council, labor leader, still acting as a labor leader.
Yeah, that's right.
So why is he on the list?
The Building Construction Trades Council, they do all kinds of political, they're really heavy on political issues. They are a funder of them. They have lots of troops that go on the ground that get involved in these in ballot issues. This year, the attempt to repeal Prop 6, that's one of their things. Last year, or earlier this year rather, the fight over infrastructure, funding that, they were involved in that. Anything building big projects, Building Construction Trades Council is there.
And they can put their boots on the ground.
I mean,
you know, they can get people to turn out the vote.
They can, and they're like the firefighters. They're all over the place, and they got a lot of dough.
And so they are relevant in state politics.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, up next, the countdown continues. Top five. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Capital Weekly editor John Howard.
Yeah.
You can show our audience.
My shameless plug. It's time right now.
The top 10 most powerful behind-the-scenes players in California. You actually cover the top 100. We're focusing on the top 10. At number five is someone new to the top 10, Mona Pasquale, who's Governor Brown's appointments secretary.
Yeah.
What's an appointment secretary and why is she important?
She vets all of the people that Brown appoints positions in state government. And so she is the person you have to get by. If you want to work for the administration, she's the person.
Or be appointed to any kind of panel or commission, anything.
Yeah.
And there's
she
a
has
lot
to vet
of
you.
Commissions.
Yes. And all of us have things in our background where we'd rather not have everybody know, okay? And that's probably a good thing. Well, I don't work for government. I don't know about you, but
I'm taking the fifth.
But Mona is essential for that, and she's very much on the inside. She kind of knows all the secrets, and she's very discreet, obviously. And she's also good. She's got good political instincts on her own. And Brown, I think, likes that. He likes her ability to do the vetting and the security stuff. But she has good political instincts.
And she also served apparently as the lieutenant governor back in 2009 for a short period.
That's right.
So she has that on her resume as well.
Yeah.
So number four, newcomer of sorts to the top 10, and that's Michael Cohen, the director of the California Department of Finance. I guess he who has the gold makes the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was gone last year.
Okay.
He was on the year before that. He was actually ill. And last year we had, Amy, I'm blanking on her name, but she was a deputy director at finance, sort of a number two person. And she was on the list last year. Our theory was that you have to have somebody from finance. They write the governor's budget. So we had her this year. Michael Cohen is back as director. I think he's going somewhere else, too. I think he's already announced he's leaving. But
yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, the California budget is, what, about $138 billion. But if you add the federal dollars and all the other dollars in it, it jumps up to $201 billion.
Totally. Yeah, it's a lot of debt.
That's a chunk of change.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. Yeah. A lot of money. And by the way, there's also an issue going on now with the census. I assume the Department of Finance is going to be pretty involved in that because they don't want it to be undercounted because then California loses money.
That's absolutely true. The undercount, in fact, we just happen to be doing a story on that right now. But the undercount, the dreaded word is undercount. The census is developing right now, obviously, for 2020. It's a snapshot in time as of April 2020. The state has committed $90 million, I think it is. And there's more than that. There's some money that's been donated, over $100 million in California to make sure we have a good census.
And that's where the whole issue of, you know, are they going to ask your citizenship on the census? Will that scare people away from, that may result in an undercount. Okay, steady, the third most powerful person in California politics and government is Mary Nichols.
Never heard of her.
Right, chair of the California Air Resources Board, or the ARB. So why is she on the list again?
I think for the reason she was on all the last time before, she's been sort of our environmental guru in California for years and years and years and years and years. But she's chair of the Air Resources Board, which is, I think, the premier air quality enforcer in the country. And they make rules.
She does have a national reputation.
Oh, absolutely. And the entire Northeast follows our lead on many things. And she's very well, she used to be NRDC attorney. She knows the lay of the land. She's got Brown's trust completely. She's involved in every major global warming fight there is. And of course, that's close to Brown's heart. So she's right in there. Sure. Yeah.
So at number two is another person with a Valley connection. By the way, a founding member of the Maddie Institute, Diana Dooley, former Secretary of Health and Human Services and current Chief of Staff of the Governor's Office. And I have an interesting story about Diana. When she stepped off our board is when the governor appointed her as Secretary of HHS. And actually, she was the first appointment in Governor Brown's this most recent go-around.
That's right,
She was the first appointment. Yeah. And she had to call me and say, sorry, I have to step off the board because we're a nonpartisan institute. So anyway, a little connection with Diana Dooley.
Not only was she the first appointment, she was appointed before he took office.
Yeah.
So
he was very clear he wanted her.
He wanted her for all kinds of different reasons. Diana Dooley, as Health and Human Services Secretary, was also chair of the Board of Covered California.
So that the Affordable Care Act's implementation in California. Yeah.
Putting that in California, the implementing that, defining the market. She was at the center of that for many years. She's also very close to Brown. So whether she's Health and Human Services Secretary or Executive Secretary, she's close to Brown, has his ear.
And secretary is an important title in the Brown administration.
Very much, yeah.
Remember that,
right? That's right.
But it's interesting when a lot of people look at the implementation of the ACA around the country, Obamacare, they point to California as one of the successes, that it was rolled out very well. And Diana Dooley has a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
So the most influential behind-the-scenes person, someone we talked about
is
earlier.
Is John Howard. No, that's not on the list. No. Okay. It's a mistake.
Well, then you may need to talk to the First Lady about that because you've got her as the number one person and Gust Brown.
Yeah. Again, this was an interesting call for me. I didn't think this was the right. I was thinking of Diana Dooley as number one. But I ran that by a lot of people who actually know a lot more about the horseshoe, about the inside than I do. And it was a good call. She had stepped back temporarily, going to Colusa, spending a lot of time on family issues on the ranch and doing sort of stuff.
It's pretty Spartan, my understanding.
Not that I'd been there. I saw a photo that looked like a one-room cabin on stilts or something. So she does a lot of that. She came back after Nancy McFadden, who had been executive secretary. So she came back in and took over. The reason I think she was number one, the defining reason for me, was that she was responsible for, at the end of the day, for giving the approval for Diana to come back as executive secretary. So I thought if she had that clout, then she should be number one.
Quite the team. Yeah. Well, up next, 2019 is going to bring us a new governor. And while we have to wait until the fall of 2019 to see who became the key players that year, we're going to hazard a guess who they might be and why they might be on next year's list. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Capital Weekly editor John Howard about the top 10 most powerful behind-the-scenes players in California politics and government. Some of the folks on this year's list aren't going to appear probably on next year's list because we're going to have a new governor, new issues. So who might be the key players in 2019? Regardless of how you feel about Governor Brown, no question he's been the 800-pound gorilla of state politics for some time. So members of administration are going to be moving out. New people are moving in. One of the questions is the legislature going to be assert itself more than it has in the past with a new governor? And will that change who the influential people are?
You know, it's hard to answer that. I mean, my guess is the answer is yes, it will assert itself more. I'm only basing that really in sort of a gut instinct. I think that there'll be changes in the leadership in the, obviously in the governor's office. Some of those people may want to stay, some may not. There's sort of a thing going on now called waiting for the next governor. Who will that, you know, if it's Cox, if it's Newsom, they're going to come in with their own people. And so whoever they bring in is probably going to be on our list. Proximity to the governor and trust of the governor sort of defines the top of this list. It has in years past.
Okay. You know, union leaders are consistently appearing on this list, throughout the 100, top 100, but certainly even in the top 10.
Yeah.
And they say that, you know, money is the mother's milk of politics.
Yeah.
You have this recent Supreme Court decision in Janus that looks like it's going to have a significant effect on union resources, probably deplete them to some extent. So what effect will that have on the labor movement's influence in state politics?
I think it will deplete their resources. I think publicly they say that it won't. It certainly energized the unions worried about that decision, not being able to collect agency fees, not being able to get that funding automatically, have it paycheck deducted, for example. That's got to cut into their revenue. But the other side of that is they were waiting for that. They thought it would come. And they've taken preparations to deal with that. And certainly they're energized and motivated.
Yeah, I think that's going to be more grassroots as opposed to automatically getting the dues. They have to go talk to their members a little more. The problem for unions is, though, that you know they have to represent everyone in the bargaining unit covered by the contract, whether or not they're paying union dues or agency fees. So, you know, it's money going out, but money may not be coming in.
It's always tough for them to do that. I agree. And one of the hard things for them, I think, is to, at least with this issue, is to make sure they retain the enthusiasm of their membership.
It's voluntary now. So members are going to get the benefit, but they don't have to pay for it if they don't want to. So that could be problematic for unions, I think. I think I've seen studies, you know, they're saying maybe 20 or 30% reduction in dues when this happened in places like Wisconsin and things like that. So I guess we'll wait and see. Another factor that's going to drive people that's on the list, typically, it seems like, are the issues that are each year that come out. What issues do you think are going to be big next year that's going to be kind of pushing who's most influential in state politics in 2019?
You know, I think some of that is going to depend on what happens in D.C. I think environmental issues in California never go away. That will be here next year. I think the whole notion of California versus the feds, that's not going away. Last count, I think there are 26 lawsuits out there, something the state has filed against the feds. Clearly, immigration isn't going away. I think if I had to pick any one single issue, I think there's going to be a push for health care stronger than there was now. We may have, next year, maybe the health care debate. Gavin Newsom has signaled that he's interested in having the debate. John Cox, I think, would be interested in the debate. I think this would be an issue for him. I think there's going to be a lot of discussion, depending on how the politics works out. But I think healthcare would be a big issue.
Yeah, let's talk about that. So if you think that you know it's going to be the environment, the lawsuits, immigration, healthcare, so who are the key players then? It would seem like one would be the Attorney General is going to carry a pretty significant role.
I think the Attorney General is at the center of a lot of...
People in his office. He's the elected office, but people who work with him.
No, that's absolutely true. And to the extent that this... You know, we're involved in lawsuits as they relate to the government, they relate to the feds. Those are the high visibility things. But there are other issues out there as well. I remember when Brown was Attorney General, he filed, I think it was against San Bernardino County, for failing to implement its county plan in an environmentally proper way. I think you're going to see more of that. I think the environment always plays a role here. Specifically, whatever they are, could be anything. But that issue, the environmental issue, will be big next year.
And if you think healthcare is going to be important, I assume then that who's ever appointed as Secretary of HHS and maybe the people that work with them or the people that they listen to are also going to be pretty influential.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think you're going to see rates going up. That's happened, I think, twice over the past year. I think they're going to happen again. They may have already been announced, actually. So healthcare costs are going to go up in some fashion through Covered California. I think Medi-Cal is going to be expanded still more. It went from 6 or 7 million people covered to over 13 million, 14 million.
And we didn't even talk about affordable housing. So
I'll leave
that alone. I want to thank John Howard, the editor of Capital Weekly, for joining us. You want to stay up on state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org.
Up next, who are the Valley Movers and Shakers? We'll hear from Tim Sheehan of the Fresno Bee, Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star and the Modesto Bee, and Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta.
Every year we ask the same question. Who are the most influential unelected people in Valley politics? The issues are getting they're getting more attention, sometimes change those who are the most influential. Then there are, of course, the changing political landscape happens every year. But we're going to ask who are the players and movers and shakers now. We've got Tim Sheehan from the Fresno Bee. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you.
We've got Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times Delta. Welcome, Paul.
Well, Mark.
There you go. And Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star and the Modesto Bee. Welcome, Mike.
Hello.
There you go. Up north takes a little longer to travel, I think. Anyway, so Tim Sheehan with the Fresno Bee, let's start with you. Have the big political donors, you know, business, labor, et cetera, stayed the same in your mind? And by the way, have things changed in light of the recent Supreme Court decision in Janus that could really seriously put a hit on unions financially?
I think for the time being, we're probably going to see very little effect of the Janus decision because it is so new. In terms of the big political donors, I think a lot of the players are staying the same. You know, you've got your police and public safety unions. They're always courted by candidates of all political stripes.
And by the way, a lot of people think the Janus decision really isn't going to affect police and fire because there's kind of a quote-unquote brotherhood there. They'll still stay in the union. They'll still pay union dues.
It's a different type of union model, exactly, right, as opposed to labor unions or things like that. Yeah.
Laborers or yeah.
Right.
Okay.
But, so, you know, I think in the context of those, you know, I don't think we'll see you've got that. Everybody loves to get endorsed by police and fire. Everybody loves to get the contributions to be able to say the police and fire departments back me. First responders, everybody's in love with first responders when it comes to politics. When it comes to, you know, labor unions or trade unions or things like that, I don't think we're going to see the same type of cross-pollination.
You know, it's interesting, though. People sometimes don't understand, you know, the police union and the firefighters union, when they endorse, they do it under the guise of frankly, public safety.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have an agenda for their members, which they should.
Absolutely.
They're representing their members.
Absolutely.
And so sometimes I think people forget that, you know, it's beyond public safety. It's also representing their own members.
There's financial skin in the game. How much of a raise can we get, and who, which candidates are going to be most likely to support additional resources for equipment, services.
And you want a friendly face on this side of the table when you're negotiating.
Absolutely.
I mean, who wouldn't, right?
Right, exactly. But I don't think we're going to see that same type of cross-pollination with your traditional labor unions because right. you've got a set of core anti-labor folks that are out there who they won't take on police and fire, but they will take on, say, teachers or construction workers and trade unions.
Right.
It's a different type of face. But I don't think it's necessarily going to affect financially this particular election cycle. You still have the unions and their PACs that are going to back who they want to back.
Yeah. So, Paul, what about down in the South Valley and Tulare and down there? I mean, are the big political donors, have they changed much?
Well, I'd like to make two points, and I agree. I agree with Tim on the effect of the Janus decision. We're not going to see that in this cycle. But first point, you see a lot of money coming in from outside, and those are in the really strongly contested partisan races. The second point is regarding the unions. Yes, everybody just wants union support. There isn't a lot of strong union activity in this area, the South Valley, except for the public sector. Those unions, police, fire, teachers, those are still strong. And because the nonpartisan races have been kind of lukewarm, there's no big issue emerging. There's no hot button thing. There's no topic that is going to rile the union membership. So really, I'm seeing that much activity regarding unions, organized labor in this season's campaign.
You know, Mike, what about up north? What are you seeing up there?
Well, I think the more interesting part of your question from our perspective is who can turn out the vote. Mm-hmm. And, I agree with Paul that the unions are not red hot on any issue, but we're seeing a whole host of different groups arise. And a lot of it's, you know, the millennials taking charge. Some of it is ground in the Latino groups, you know, Mi Familia Vota has got a ground game working in Stanislaus County. We've got all these new groups, Modesto Progressive Democrats, Stanislaus Young Democrats, Revolution Turlock, Healthcare for All in Merced. There's a Tracy group, a Manteca group, and we're getting these new faces. We've got a former rock promoter, rock and roll show, festival promoter, and he's becoming quite a force in local Democratic politics. And there's others, and they're all young. And their money seems to be coming sort of from the Bay Area in some cases, but more grassroots than others.
Yeah. Well, let me switch gears a little bit and talk about education. I'm sorry. Is that Paul?
Yeah, I would second that, Mark. Mike's observations about some new groups emerging, some new titles, some new faces, some we haven't heard of. And grassroots groups organizing and galvanizing about specific issues, immigration reform, women's rights, workplace rights,
that kind of thing. So it's happening here too.
Well, let's kind of jump through some of the issues kind of quickly here. Paul, we'll start with you on education policy, and we'll talk to each of you on this. So who are the movers and shakers in South Valley when it comes to education policy, the unelected people? Are there superintendents that are particularly persuasive or influential in this area?
The longest-serving politician, the government holder elected, Jim Vidak, is retiring this year, and there is an election for his seat. Now, we're talking about unelected, but still, the Tulare County Office of Education is probably the strongest force as far as education philosophy and policy, and as well as boots on the ground kind of stuff in education here in Tulare County. And that's been Jim Vidak for 24 years. So how that election comes out is going to be interesting. The unions in this case, they are influential about education policy and how things work. The teacher in the classroom over the last few years has been gotten burned, and they're starting to realize it, and they're coming out as a force, not just in salary, but in working conditions.
Now, you're saying that around the country.
It's starting now. By the next election, it's going to be a big deal.
Yeah. Mike, what about up north? Who are the players in education policy that are unelected up north?
Well, I mean, you've got Dorothy Leland at UC Merced. I mean, she's powerhouse. I mean, she's reinventing the city of Merced. They built a major office building downtown. They've got several hundred people working down there. At CSU, Stanislaw and Turlock, Ellen Jun.
By the way, Mike, I've been there. It's a beautiful facility.
Oh, yeah, it is. It's nice. And she's low key in like her, when you meet her, you think she's low key, and you get to talking to her and you realize this gal's got it going on. I hope she never retires. Ellen Jun in Turlock, with CSU. I mean, she's kind of stepped up as in the forefront of some of the anti-hate stuff. Part of that might be that, you know, they had a major figure attending classes there in the neo-Nazi or white nationalist movement. He's now gone. But we got some more minor leaguers, too. I mean, I'm going to call them minor leaguers. I mean, they're working hard. We've got a gal working for our library called Olga. Her name is Olga Cardenas. And she's taking reading programs into jails, into poor neighborhoods, into labor camps. Anywhere there's a kid who wants to read, she's bringing books. And she's getting help from the Stanislaw Community Foundation to give those books away. I wish I could say Modesto City Schools, which is the biggest district around here, was in the forefront. But we're having a little bit of a tiff with them right now. One of their board members, who likes to wear a cowboy hat, he called one of our reporters some rather nasty names, and then they voted a gag order not to talk to us. They're bored. I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Well, we live in strange times. Let me ask Tim about this. By the way, I should mention this. Kind of interesting about the university leadership here. You know, you've got Joe Castro at Fresno State from the Valley. Ellen Jun was an administrative position at Fresno State. She's now president at Cal State Stanislaus. So you've got Lynette Zalesny, now president at Cal State Bakersfield, also was the provost at Cal State Fresno. So you've got the university leadership has a real connection to the Valley, which is kind of interesting. But Tim, you know, in Fresno, you know, Mike Hansen's gone from Fresno Unified.
Right.
Who are the kind of the players in education policy here in the local area?
Well, you know, last year when we talked about this, I mentioned Joseph Castro at Fresno State, you know, bringing the university to the forefront with his Be Bold campaign and efforts to bring the university more to the forefront in the community. This year, I would have to point at the community college leaders, Carol Goldsmith, the president of Fresno City College, Brenda Thames, excuse me, at West Hills Kalinga, Kristen Clark at West Hills Lemoore, Donna Berry, who's the interim president at Reedley College, and Bert Calvin at COS in Visalia. These leaders face the challenge of essentially in the community college system being all things to all people. They have to focus on increasing demands for vocational education. They have to focus on academic preparation, preparing their students who are aiming for an associate degree to transfer to the CSUs or UC systems. So they have to deal with vocational prep as well as academic advancement. And they're doing so with the open door mission that the community colleges have always had about taking all comers. If you're 18 and you're a high school graduate, you get to go to a community college, regardless of academic or vocational aptitude. So in my mind, they're playing a huge role in terms of training, meeting training demands for industries that are needing workers that have more aptitude than fast food, and also continuing to prepare for students who may not necessarily be able to afford going right to a CSU or UC system.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Community college is taking a greater and greater role in education. I'm going to, for an essence of time, we've only got about 4 minutes left in the segment, I'm going to jump around a little bit here and talk about some economic issues, things like affordable housing or ag or economic development generally. So I'm going to go around the horn here. Mike, we'll start with you. You're talking about affordable housing, or you're talking about ag water, or you're talking about economic development. Who are the kind of the players in those areas, in your mind, in the North Valley?
Well, North Valley, I mean, we're not seeing a big boom here in housing like we saw back in 2002, 2007, that area. It's more of a rumble, but we're just not seeing the big developments. But when it comes to ag and water in particular, I mean, we're in a fight for our lives. And the leaders here on that issue, you know, you have Michelle Reimers at TID, John Swigert at Merced Irrigation District, Paul Winger, who was the California Farm Bureau president, and his son Jake, who probably knows more about water than most people. They're all leading this fight. And then you got scientists like Peter Moyle and Doug Demko. So we're, you know, the state on November 7 is going to rule about how much water they want to leave in the rivers. And that is going to impact everybody here. It's a fight.
Yeah. Paul, let me ask you the same question. Kind of look at economic development, affordable housing, ag, those kinds of issues. Who are the major players down south?
We are having another sort of mini boom in housing. The players are from out of the area, though. The local developers have sort of taken a back seat. On the water issue, though, I would absolutely second what Tim said about we're in a fight. it's really coming, and it's the irrigation districts and especially the Kalia Delta Water Conservation District here, which represents a number of irrigation districts, who are pushing that. They've got very competent leadership there. They know what they're doing, and they have convinced ag farmers that the best way, their best strategy, is to be as efficient, as conserving as they can with water, and the farmers are responding. You look around and you see everybody's going to drip irrigation, everybody's going to much more efficient ways of irrigating their crops. Everybody is trying as hard as they can not to take groundwater.
What's interesting about that?
When they come to the table, they're going to have that credential.
What's interesting about that is, for groundwater recharge, what they want to do is sometimes flood some of these farmlands, but they can't do it because they got the drip irrigation. They're kind of conflicted on that issue, so that's interesting. Let me talk to Tim. We've only got about a minute left in this segment.
Sure.
I want to ask you on economic issues, affordable housing, ag, those kinds of things. Who are the players in the Central Valley, in Fresno?
When it comes to affordable housing, your developers will get into affordable housing when it pencils out for them to do it. There has to be some tax credits or other incentives for them to do it. So I would tend to point toward some place like the Fresno Housing Authority, which not only administers Section 8 housing here in Fresno, they're also a developer of affordable housing. When it comes to water, agricultural water in particular, I was going to be tempted to say Jose Ramirez with his fights for water, the world champion boxer, but unfortunately, Jose's not building dams or canals. I would say the biggest player that is the California Water Commission, which so far has yet to pony up the big bucks that local water officials want to build a new dam at Temperance Flat upstream on the San Joaquin River from Millerton Lake. That's been the big holdup.
Yeah, okay. Well, up next, we're going to talk more about the influential folks here in the Valley. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report Valley Views Edition.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
You're listening to the Maddie Report Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking with political observers from throughout the Valley, Paul Hurley, formerly with the Visalia Times-Delta, Tim Sheehan with the Fresno Bee, Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun-Star and Modesto Bee, about those folks who are unelected yet highly influential when it comes to local politics and government. So, Mike Dunbar, with the Merced Sun Star Modesto Bee, let me go to you. When it comes to transportation issues, who are the most influential in the North Valley?
Well, that's a good question. But we here in Modesto, we have a guy by the name of Paul Van Kneinenberg, who's a member of the California Transportation Committee. So he's low-key, kind of quiet guy, but he's...
That's a pretty important position.
Pretty important. He's making... You know, yeah, and then you wanted people who are not elected, but I don't think...
Excuse me for a second. Just by the way, so I'm assuming everyone knows what the California Transportation Commission is. Could you briefly describe what the California Transportation Commission is, what they do?
Well, they prioritize and set up the funding for specific projects for various, you know, regions, regional
throughout the entire state. They basically set transportation policy for California, right?
Well, they set the priorities, that's for certain. And, I mean, they're the ones who you've got to have a voice at that table if you want to get your roads built, your major roads built.
So
having Paul there is a big deal. But I don't think you can overlook Anthony Cannella. He's about to be termed out, so I'm going to mention him. But he was the deciding vote in the Senate for the gas tax. And he has been he's a Republican, and he has been the object of extreme anger from his own party. Yet he had the courage to do it.
He got you the ACE train.
And I think that's going to be a big deal here.
Right? He got you the ACE train as part of that deal, which was several hundred million dollars to connect the North Valley with San Jose. And if you think about, you know, not driving on those, you know, those roads to over to the Bay Area, but instead taking a commuter train, all of a sudden North Valley opens up in terms of a housing possibility for a lot of folks who can't afford Silicon Valley.
Well, our whole downtown area is counting on that, because here in Modesto, we have a downtown station that's going to come through here. In Merced, it's going to create this hub with eventually high-speed rail, Amtrak, and the ACE train, all three together in a single spot. I mean, so you're really opening up these communities to you're bridging that chasm that separates us from Silicon Valley, where the incomes are four times higher than they are here, or five times higher. Yeah. So you're creating something that doesn't exist, which we are very anxious for.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. You know, where Merced and Modesto sit, I mean, they can connect both to the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, and frankly, Sacramento. And you also have a UC there. There is a tremendous amount of potential in that area, obviously. Let me go to the Tim, you know, Tim Sheehan with the Fresno Bee. In Fresno, when it comes to transportation, who are the players?
I would say it's the folks who control the purse strings for Measure C, which is within Fresno County, our half-cent sales tax measure for transportation and roads. One of the controlling agencies for that is the local council of governments, which in itself is largely a group of local elected officials. Tony Bourne's the executive director. So him not being elected, I would have to probably point to him and his staff. They're the ones who do the analysis. They're the ones who make the recommendations as far as the priorities for what projects in Fresno County will get that Measure C funding.
He who has the gold makes the rules.
Exactly, yes. And since Measure C supplements what Caltrans can't pay for, it's crucial.
Okay. Paul, what about down south? Who are the players in transportation policy?
Well, it's very similar. Those who are controlling the major decisions about how Measure R funds are expended. And so far, they've been doing a very good job. I think the voters would renew this when it comes time to, because they have they've dedicated resources to the right projects to make improvements. That said, unfortunately, I think this area is ignoring some things that are coming down the road at them that they're not prepared for, including a high-speed rail. I'm sorry, but the project is going forward, and expansion of some of our freeways. There have been improvements to Highway 99, not quite as much to Highway 198, and until someone starts to realize that, well, we need to start thinking about expanding those roads, things are going to stall a little bit.
I like your analogy of down the road and stalling. We're talking about transportation. Excellent choice of words there, Paul. Let me go on. Let me go to Tim Sheehan with the Fresno Bee on crime and public safety issues. Who are the major players in Fresno and Clovis when it comes to crime and public safety?
Well, since we can't go with electeds, that rules out the sheriff. So almost by default, I'd have to go with, right off the top of my head, Police Chief Jerry Dyer and the other local police chiefs.
He's been a fixture forever.
Exactly. And the local chiefs have the most influence on the day-to-day policing. Chief Dyer's been steering Fresno toward a style of community-based policing in which ideally people get to know the police officers in their part of town and vice versa. The officers get to know the people in their part of town. I think it's also worth noting that here in Fresno, we've got this Office of Independent Review, or the Police Auditor, and that's former FBI fellow John Gliotta. He gets the unenviable task of reviewing complaints against police officers, including use of force and officer-involved shootings. It takes a little bit of chutzpah, I guess, for lack of a better word, for his office to be able to rule in some instances that a police shooting, such as the Dylan Noble case in 2016, that some aspects of that were outside of established department policy, even though no criminal charges or no liability or fault was found by the district attorney or criminal charges. But that was the focus of a $2.3 million settlement with the family.
Now that'll get your attention.
Sure.
The city. So, Paul Hurley, down south, when it comes to public safety, who are the people that really influence policy that are unelected?
Unelected is Police Jason Salazar in Visalia. Sheriff Mike Boudreau is elected. He's doing a pretty good job as sheriff. Salazar, Chief Salazar in Visalia, has continued and initiated some very progressive policing measures, community policing, a very innovative approach to dealing with the homeless, use of body cameras,
the question is,
community issue, really getting police out there.
Paul, the question is he effective?
I'm sorry, what?
Is he effective? Are crime rates going down?
Actually, I just heard a presentation from Chief last week, and crime rates are going down. There's two parts of that answer. Overall, violent crime is going down. Gang-related crime is decreasing. Minor property crimes are increasing, and the chief attributes that, of course, to Prop 647.
Yeah, that's trending. That's the way it's trending statewide as well. Mike, let me ask you, we've only got about a minute left in the segment. So when it comes to public safety up north, who are the people, the unelected folks that are having a big influence on policy?
Well, I'm echoing both Paul and Tim. It's Modesto's police chief, I think, who's driving this squad car, if you will. He's very progressive in how he approaches police work. That doesn't make him a liberal, but he brought in the body cameras very quickly and loves them. I think he actually convinced our sheriff who said he would have them over his dead body. I think he convinced that sheriff that they were a good deal. He's created real communication with some of our minority communities, put a lot of effort into that, personal effort. He brought in predictive policing so that these are computer programs that crunch all the data and tell you where crime is most likely to occur at any given moment. So you can put your cars, you can locate them in those spots. He's required substantial training, I think it's over 40 hours, for dealing with those who are mentally unstable. We had a guy, I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's a big part of it. We're running out of time, but that is a very, very big part of the issue. But unfortunately, Mike, we're out of time. I want to thank our guests, Tim Sheehan with the Fresno Bee, Paul Hurley from the Visalia Times-Delta, and Mike, I apologize for cutting you off there, Mike Dunbar with the Merced Sun Star and the Modesto Bee. Thanks, both all of you, for joining us. Appreciate it.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.